European and Japanese wish to maintain their progress of globalization, especially the trade activities.
Japan and the EU agree to a massive free trade deal. It's Wednesday, July 18th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, not all Asian Americans thrive in the United States. Trying to still speak the language in Australia. China bets on the World Cup. Kids build guitars. Muppets on display. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Japan and the European Union signed one of the largest free trade agreements Tuesday that covers nearly one-third of the global economy and over a half billion people, and eliminates nearly all tariffs. It followed by a visit to Beijing, EU Council President Donald Tusk and European Commission head Jean-Claude Juncker, who have been preaching open global trade and against what they called the conflict and chaos of protectionism. The EU-Japan Economic Partnership Agreement is the culmination of 5 years of negotiations. Their respective parliaments must ratify the pact, which is expected to come into force next March, about the time Britain leaves the EU. J.P. Morgan senior economist Masamichi Adachi in Tokyo tells VOA's Victor Beatty this will give a boost to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's economic priority of reigniting the world's fourth largest economy.
He's pushing this free trade agreement to many countries, including this Europe. And he's sort of now trying to be a protector of a free trade world against the attempt by the President Trump to block the many areas. So for Abe, it's for the promise to the own people and also to the international community that he's now trying to prevent the protectionist move in the world.
This covers one-third of the global economy and more than 600 million people. This is a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big deal. But of course, you can argue that it's not the 100% abandon of the tariff or something. It's still a managed agreement, which is probably better than the blocking and threatening other counterparts.
This obviously goes against the trade tensions that involves the U.S. and other parts of the world over trade policies. Obviously, Japan is not going along with these trade restrictions or trying to avoid them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, both European and Japanese wish to maintain the progress of globalization, especially the trade activities. Therefore, it's ironical that U.S. President Trump's attempt to block borders, which actually pushing closer relationship between Europe and Japan.
The two EU leaders, Mr. Juncker and Mr. Tusk, just arrived from China, where they held talks. Obviously, they're going through Asia and see that's great opportunities there.
Yes, I think the even without trade tensions in the world, Europe and Asia both wanted to have a more close relationship. So for the European side, probably this is a very important time to persuade leaders in Asia, including Japan, to continue this effort to maintain this free trade world.
Is this trade deal a substitute for what was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
It's not a substitute. It's a supplement, I think, because the TPP is, Pacific regions, and the EU and Japan is, over the Eurasia, Asia. Over the Asia. So, I'm talking about the continent of Euro-Asia. Therefore, regionally, it's actually a supplement, not objecting each other.
But the TPP is going ahead, you say?
Yes, that's what the Japanese government want to see. I mean, the Japanese government and the Prime Minister Abe are definitely pushing the TPP-11 and eventually will invite the U.S. back to again.
The Trump administration withdrew from the TPP shortly after taking office in 2017. Both the TPP and China's Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership already involve many countries in Asia, including Japan. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find currently trending on VOAnews.com. EU and Japan sign massive free trade deal. Hong Kong moves to ban pro-independence political party. Myanmar Reuters reporter says he was hooded and deprived of sleep. Top U.S. official says China overloading poor nations with debt. Taiwan's Apache fleet goes into service amid China tensions. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are to be found on Facebook at VOA Asia, and a great destination for you is our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. There's a saying that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. It refers to a growing inequality gap, and it's present here in the United States as in many other nations across the globe. However, the results of a new study on the topic might surprise many. It shows Asian Americans are hardest hit by inequality in the United States. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Rakesh Coucher, the senior researcher for the Pew Research Center and chief author of the study.
Our main finding is that income inequality in America varies strikingly from one group to another. Today, inequality we find is greatest among Asians in the United States. And this is the result of a near doubling in income inequality among Asians from 1970 to 2016. And in this process, they displaced blacks as the most economically divided group in the U.S.
This sounds surprising because when people in the United States, as we have both talked to many of them, think of Asian Americans, we think of very well-established and financially successful people. So what happened?
Now, it is true that on average, they are better off than other groups, but our research presents a more nuanced picture of the diversity in this population.
Such as?
So what we find is, first of all, as we noted, income inequality is the highest within this group, and it has also increased tremendously in the last 4 to 5 decades. And this reflects the diversity and origins of this population, which is still principally driven through immigration. Since 1970, 80% of the growth in this population is due to immigration alone. And these immigrants have come for a variety of reasons from a variety of countries. They range from people who are here for reasons of family reunification, or they came as refugees following the end of the Vietnam War, or more recently, they came under the more skill-based visa system, the H-1B visa program, to work in the technology sector or the healthcare sector. And then there are others who came here for graduate studies and have established successful careers in the United States. So this diversity is reflected in the diversity of their economic outcomes.
Now, how much of these numbers and do these findings correlate with the increase and the greater number of immigrants from Asia to the United States?
Well, they correlate in the sense that this is a population in transition. It is rapidly changing. Just in the last 20 years, the population has doubled, and it has increased 14-fold since 1970. So it is a population demographically in rapid transit, and what we are seeing is the picture of that transition at the moment. What it looks like in the future as the second generation and the third generation come to settle and into the labor market and we see their economic outcomes, that's something we cannot predict. But at the moment, we're definitely in a phase of transition.
Is there a geographic definition as to those doing well and those not doing so well?
Well, if you look at this by country of origin, a few things we do know. This is from related research, not in this specific research of ours, that some groups such as Indians, for example, or people from the Philippines or Japan, they are among the better off among the Asian American population. Their education levels are high and their incomes are high. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, people not doing well include the Hmong and the Cambodians and the Bhutanese. Poverty rates approaching as high as 33% and incomes also on the low side. And that correlates with relatively lower levels of education among certain groups.
Rakesh Kaushar also says financial inequality is on the rise at a very rapid pace in the United States. He says it is higher and increasing more quickly compared to other G7 nations. Kaushar spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Happening now in Asia, one of two Reuters journalists jailed in Myanmar maintained his innocence to charges he broke the country's secrecy laws in reporting on the Rohingya refugee crisis. The pair were arrested in December, accused of possessing documents linked to security operations against Rohingya militants. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Indigenous elders in Central Australia are leading efforts to save a critically endangered language. Phil Mercer in Sydney tells us of the estimated 300 Indigenous languages that once existed in Australia, and now only 90 are still spoken.
Language is a critical part of Indigenous culture in Australia. It's a repository for tribal knowledge, history and customs, and gives communities a valuable sense of identity. About 300 languages existed when European settlers arrived in Australia in the late 1700s. Although around 90 have survived, only about 60 are considered to be alive and in regular use. Others are considered to be critically endangered as tribal elders pass away. Academics say that colonisation has also had an adverse effect on Indigenous languages. In the Central Australian desert near Alice Springs, only 20 people are fluent in Potame, but children are being taught its ancient words in the hope that it won't die out. Community leaders say that for decades they were forbidden by their white teachers to speak their native tongue, but they did so in secret to help it survive. Tribal elder Kathleen Bradshaw.
This teacher walked past and said, "Do not speak that lingo at school." And we promised ourselves that we would talk it in secret and just keep it going and, you know, talk amongst ourselves in secret. I think a lot of non-Indigenous people, they do not understand how important it is for Aboriginal people to have their language and to keep it strong.
The Northern Territory in Australia has schools where students learn in both English and an Aboriginal language. Many communities speak what's called Aboriginal English, that reflects Indigenous language and culture. Its structure adheres to some patterns of standard English, as well as including words originating from Aboriginal languages. Creole is a North Australian Creole that's spoken by children whose parents were fluent in different tribal languages. Aboriginal Australians make up about 3% of Australia's population. They suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Archaeological evidence has suggested that Aboriginal people have been in Australia for at least 65,000 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, you bet the World Cup is big in China. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Your requests, your dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia, authorities in Hong Kong have begun the unprecedented step of outlawing a political party that advocates the territory's independence from China. Secretary for Security John Lee said the move falls under an ordinance that cites the interest of national security and public safety. He did not specify any accusations against the group. You're always free to visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, China wagers on the World Cup, and Japan offers highly individualized clothing in this week's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
China didn't make it to football's World Cup, but that didn't stop people from betting big on the games. World Cup lottery bets in China in the first 3 weeks of the matches outstripped the whole of the 2014 tournament in Brazil. Xia Lugan is a shop owner of a China sports lottery in northern Shanghai's Hongkou district.
During the World Cup, many people in China who are normally not interested in football, their enthusiasm is brought up now. So, the turnover of the lottery shop has gone up quite a lot.
6 years ago, Xia Lugan converted his auto shop into a run-down, smoky betting shop in downtown Shanghai. He says business boomed during the World Cup, with hundreds of thousands of yuan being bet daily, more than 10 times the stakes for a normal day. According to the China Sports Lottery Management Center, China spent 28.6 billion yuan in the first 3 weeks up to July 1st, dwarfing the less than 5 billion wagered in the 3 weeks before that. While gambling is technically illegal in China, China's Sports Administration is allowed to run these lottery shops and uses the proceeds to reinvest in the country's athletes and sports infrastructure. Perhaps the investment will help China qualify in 4 years for the next World Cup, as so many hope. Technology meets fashion in the latest creation by Japanese e-commerce company Start Today. The retailer invented a skin-tight suit with 300 sensors that translate information about your body measurements to a phone app. After the suit measures you, algorithms process the data to determine the fit of your clothes. The technology allows the company to create clothes tailored specifically to a person's body, taking a step away from standardized sizing. Yusaku Mizawa is the chief executive officer of Start Today.
The time where people adapt to clothing is over. This is a new era where clothes adapt to people.
Shoppable ZOZOTOWN sites will go live across the world on July 30th, including in Australia, China, Brazil, India, the U.S., and the U.K. Yusaku Mizawa.
This ZOZO revolution started in Japan today. Today, it travels to more than 72 countries.
The ZOZO brand is on track to ship 1 million ZOZO suits to customers by the end of July. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Taiwan has put into service its fleet of U.S.-made Apache attack helicopters, upgrading its defenses against a growing military threat from China. The United States sold 30 of the helicopters known as the Tank Killer to Taiwan as part of a $6.5 billion arms deal announced 10 years ago that angered Beijing. You'll find more on this in the day's other news at VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, some students in Virginia who play the guitar are also learning how to build them. It's part of an after-school program where middle and high school students learn about science and music through the design and operation of an electric guitar. The workshops, sponsored by a nonprofit called Music for Life, are free for those who can't afford to participate in the education program. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to a high school in Manassas, Virginia, where the students are learning the challenges of making an electric guitar.
Jaron Wildman is trying out the first electric guitar he built at this 12-day workshop at Osborne High School in Manassas, Virginia. He says he learned a lot about what it takes to put together a guitar.
If you get one thing wrong, even just by a millimeter, then the length of the string won't be right and you won't get the correct note on your strings.
Although the students use kits to build their guitars, which they get to keep, there is still plenty of work for them to do before they can take the instrument home. Not all the students play the guitar. Audrey Doan's interest in science brought her to the workshop to understand how a guitar functions.
There's a lot to do with electricity. It's a lot about grounding and how to conduct it to make music and how much is needed and how to make the notes the way you want it to be.
Which includes putting the strings on properly and tuning the instrument.
if like something's out of place, then you can't really tune it.
Jenna Davis is feeling a little lost.
If you're okay here,
she gets help from Music for Life founder Skip Chapels.
And you're sharp here, that means your string is too short.
Chapels says while the workshops are about guitar making, they are also about providing the students with other skills.
Science that they may not have had before, but they also learn some very practical skills in woodworking, electronics, assembly, and test. They're getting an education which prepares them either for a career through college or going directly into the trades after school.
Kevin Hernandez, a guitarist who was his class president, hopes his instrument will help him reach for the stars. He appreciates that his Guatemalan parents, who are immigrants, are encouraging him to follow his dreams.
I'm trying to reach for the stars and trying to slowly progress in society. So we're living in a trailer right now, but one day, like, I want to express that, like, I touched the stars and that I made it.
Building a guitar is harder than it looks, says 11-year-old Jaden Borba.
There's a lot of different steps, and don't think it's just that it's, like, really easy to build it. It takes time and effort.
Lessons these students can use in the future, no matter where life leads them. Deborah Block, VOA News, Manassas, Virginia.
For decades, Jim Henson's Muppets have captured the imagination of children and adults worldwide. A traveling exhibit at the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles not only showcases some of the most beloved Muppets, but also the work that took place behind the scenes to entertain as well as educate. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more.
Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy, familiar faces beloved by generations of adults and children around the world. Just two of many well-known Muppets created by Jim Henson and featured in this traveling exhibit.
We're excited for people to understand that he was a very multifaceted artist, a very adventurous, creative mind.
Jim Henson's eldest daughter, Lisa, heads Los Angeles-based The Jim Henson Company and describes her father, who died in 1990, as a technology geek.
He would love to tell us how the best techniques of puppet building were the new innovations that they would make in terms of mechanics or electronics and how he was advancing the technology.
The universal appeal of Henson's work launched shows such as Sesame Street, The Muppet Show, and Fraggle Rock onto the international stage.
Hi, Bobo. Hi, Wimberly.
Hi.
你们要听我的诗吗?
Here's an episode in Mandarin.
你可问你的诗吗?
And in Spanish.
Lo hacemos, Rosy, lo prometo.
He was trying to think of how to make his work kind of connect with people and resonate with people internationally. It's a responsibility to be positive and to promote good values like acceptance, tolerance, promoting individualism and diversity. And he started to feel that responsibility more because his work was getting so popular.
Museum goers will not only see the beloved puppets from shows such as Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, they also see what it takes to bring these characters to life.
You can see original sketches, actually notes of the very beginnings of ideas, all the way through to finished puppets.
Oh, wait a minute, maybe we could coach
the exhibit is a creative archaeological experience that shows Henson's work from the 1950s to 1990. Although computer-generated imagery may have replaced some puppets in Hollywood, Lisa Henson says the art of puppetry is alive and well today.
It gives it a kind of immediacy in performance and intimacy that people connect to that and they kind of feel like that, you know, the puppets are a little more alive.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You know, technology is really great. It provides so many different ways for you to listen to our program. There's some technology that's been around for a long time, though. It's called radio. You can hear us on many great radio stations across Asia, like PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. We thank everyone who tuned in today. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team that includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.